Department for May 12th, and we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3479. I'd like to... I'll close the House Bill on 3479 and open 3328. Put them in the reverse order. Okay, let me call Stephen Kafuri. Good.
Mr. Chairman, I have Senator Chen Whitman.
Certainly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Brad Witt, representative from House District 31. Just wanted to explain to you very briefly that there have been some late-breaking concerns expressed with this bill relative to the requirement for a mandatory apprenticeship. And would ask for your consideration, Mr. Chairman, for the parties involved to have an opportunity to work that out.
Okay, great.
I believe it will be a relatively simple thing to address.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafuri. I'm representing Johnson Controls. Appreciate the opportunity to be back, and I'm grateful that this bill is scheduled for a possible work session today. I would ask you to direct your attention to the dash three amendments. The dash three just came.
We don't have them.
Do you have them?
No, I don't have them either.
Nobody gave them to us. We have dash ones, and that's it.
Yeah, they're in your office, then.
Okay.
We'll have them here shortly. I'll explain, if I may, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to say, to refresh the committee's memory, this bill has to do with energy savings performance contracts. And I already talked about the Dash 1 amendments last time, and what we did with the Dash 1 amendments were to take the concept originally in the bill, which was to have the Department of Energy do a two-year plan on energy conservation and bring it to the next session of the legislature. And the bill appropriated $100,000 for the department to draft such a plan. We figured there's no use to wait 2 years, and that we should direct the Department of Energy to begin immediately studying ways to reduce energy for state buildings and for school buildings, and that they should, as they gather that information, report it directly to those agencies rather than waiting to come back to the legislature. That's basically what the Dash 1 amendments did. And that's something that we have concurrence with the Department of Energy. They think that's a good idea as well. We have in the Dash 3 amendments talking about an energy conservation measure.
Why don't we hold on that?
Yeah,
we have
that and the other thing I have there, just very simple, is to define an energy savings performance contract. And there's been some negotiation and discussion with various interest groups in the meantime, and these dash threes represent our acceptance of some of the objections from the Department of Energy and Department of Administrative Services. I think they'll be here to tell you about some other objections they have. We didn't agree on all the objections, but we did agree on some of them. And as long as we're here and I'm on the stand and get to talk, I might as well tell you about one other. There, you're going to hear a concern from Associated General Contractors that has to do with the exemption in this bill from the contracting law. It's a technical question. Last session there was a bill drafted that passed through the legislature, and there was a drafting error made, and that the result of that was House Bill 2214. This session to clean that bill up, didn't make any technical changes. I mean, only technical changes, no substantive changes. And the concern from the AGC, which we may have gotten back into that muddy water again, it's certainly not our intent to do so. And I would request that we would run that issue back past Legislative Council again to make sure that it doesn't exempt this program from, for example, a wage and hour, right, those other kinds of portions of the law. We wanted to be exempt only from the selection process as the competitive bid requirements.
That was
2214.
14.
All right. And then that's all I have just until those amendments get back.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Talking about a dash one and a dash three, is there a dash two someplace that is hidden in the world? There's no reason.
We've got a little blank space.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I believe, and I'm not sure about that, but I believe the dash twos were an interim development in on the way between the ones and the threes that never saw this light of day. They were buried now in the archives at Legislative Council.
Okay.
All right.
And does the dash three affect in any way the dash one? Is it going to be necessary, Mr. Chair, to move the dash one to the bill and then the dash three to the bill if that is the pleasure of the group? Is that
has dash one been,
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen? I believe that everything in the dash threes is inclusive. That if you adopt the dash threes and the bill, you will take care of the dash ones.
Okay, that's good.
All right. I think we'll,
so, in essence, the dash ones are recycled material at this point, and we're waiting for the dash threes to appear before we can.
So, we'll stand at ease. Bill 3328.
Mr. Chair, the dash two amendments have reappeared from a hole, let's say, where. Hiding, and looking at them, I can see what they are. There was a concern by the Department of Energy that the bill would cost them money, and so they wanted to make sure that it didn't, and that they could do that within their existing resources. And so, as you'll see on line four of the dash two amendments, it's inserted the words "to the extent funds are available."
Mm-hmm.
Then on the next line,
in place of the $100,000.
Yes.
Okay.
The next line deletes the word "a schedule" and inserts recommendations, so that it would be again a lighter task on the Department of Energy. And then the next one, so deleting pages 4 through 7. These pages are redundant and are not necessary to be in the bill at all. It's purely technical drafting. So what I think you have in the dash two amendments is merely some language to make the agency feel good. And if I could turn your attention, please, to page 2 of the dash threes. There are two amendments in the dash threes. The first starts on page 2, and it's a definition of energy conservation measure. And you can read it. It includes equipment that's used in a new or existing building, or repairs to that building, things that are used to reduce energy consumption. There is a drafting error here again on line 5. The words "reclamation of natural," which continues over to resources. You might delete those words, "reclamation of natural resources." This was an issue that came up with the Department of Energy. There was another section that talked about definition of natural resources. We deleted that and inadvertently did not delete reclamation of natural resources. So that's, if you would delete that.
Bring me up again, line 5.
Right? Line 5, reclamation of natural resources. Just delete those words.
Okay.
That was one of the things that the Department of Energy asked us to do, and we did. Then on page 13... talks about energy saving performance contracts, and the crucial thing here is the guarantee, and this talks about the guarantee that a ESPC must contain a condition that before the end of the contract term, the contracting agency must recover the costs of the contract through avoided costs, so that, making clear here, there will be no cost to the agency over no increased costs, that all costs will be assumed through the avoided costs. And it talks in Section 2 that every energy savings performance contract must contain a condition that the contractor shall provide a guarantee that the agency will cover their costs. And the guarantee says that financial remedies that will, at a minimum, repay the contracting agency for any shortfall. I might draw your attention to line 26 on page 13, where it says, with a guarantee. There was some objection to the words by the Department of Energy that first said, with a first-party guarantee, that's what the first draft said, meaning that we as the company would be the guarantor. And this way, they were unhappy about that. We took that language out, so it now says with a guarantee, so that means that a company can get an insurance or a bond or some other party to make that guarantee. And the thought was that that would open up this process to additional contracting companies, and not all companies could guarantee it within their own funds. Then if you look on page 14, line 3, an energy saving performance contract, and the key word here is may contain a condition that the contractor will provide these things. And there's a list of the kinds of services that contractors may provide and agencies may contract for under this provision of law, should they choose.
Okay.
And that's my testimony, Mr. Chair.
All right. Very good. Any questions, Mr. Kufuri or Representative Witt?
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, next I'd like to call Dugan Petty, Bill Foster, and Blake Underwood. Dugan, I guess you're up first.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn this over to Bill Foster.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Foster. I'm the administrator of the Facilities Division of the Department of Administrative Services. And we had been asked to come and talk to the committee about some of the background about what is existing processes and statutes and rules pertaining to energy savings performance contracting. And with that, I would first like to turn it over to Blake Underwood, who's with the Department of Justice, to just give a little background on where the statutes put us.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Blake Underwood. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm General Counsel Division. Inside the division, I'm a member of the Business Transactions Section. And my focus inside that section is on design and construction contracts. With Dana Anderson, I co-chair that section. I have specific responsibility for principally design contracts, architectural engineering, land surveying contracts, design-build transactions, and specifically energy savings performance contracts. I was the principal drafter of the energy savings performance contracting rules that are part of the Attorney General's model rules, and have been part of that process originally and as they were recently adapted to deal with the requirements of the new public contracting code. What I'd like to do as just general background for the chairman and the committee is to discuss the general idea of how public improvement contracts are procured. Energy savings performance contracts are a type of a public improvement contract, a public works project, and traditionally public improvement contracts have been procured through competitive bidding. meaning that an invitation bid is used, the low bid is awarded the contract. There has been a process that has been instituted fairly recently to exempt certain kinds of public improvement contracts from the competitive bidding requirements. Contracts such as design build, construction manager general contractor contracts, but there's still a competitive process which uses a request for proposal process where competition is still encouraged. The agency is merely allowed to consider the qualifications of the contractors in some type of balanced model in addition to price considerations. Up until 2003 session, design build contracts, energy savings performance contracts were part of that process. So if an agency wanted to use a non-low bid procurement process, they would go to the Department of Administrative Services or to their contract review board and ask that an exemption from the competitive bidding requirements be granted. Certain findings would have to be found, that there was no unfair advantage, that a competitive process was available, that substantial cost savings would result from using a non-standard, non-low bid procurement process. A public hearing would be held to allow any interested parties to offer comment as to whether that exemption should really be granted. So energy savings performance contracts are part of that process. And those types of contracts, while not the norm, are on a somewhat regular basis granted for projects that are appropriate for that method. As the members of the committee and the chair undoubtedly are aware, in 2003, House Bill 3476 required that energy savings performance contracts be placed into a special classification, that they would be exempt not from all the different requirements of the public contracting laws, but merely from the specific requirements of competitive bidding, that low bid be the way that those contracts would be awarded. So in this, because of this placement in the code, they would not have to go through the exemption process that I just described. As long as the method that was used to procure the energy savings performance contract was followed the Department of Justice rules, then that process would be exempt from normal competitive bidding. I was then given the task by my boss to draft those rules, to come up with a method that would give direction to agencies as to how to go about this process. And we conducted that process in the fall of 2003 and then carrying over into 2004. So now the dash one amendments take that one step further, and they make energy savings performance contracts completely exempt from all of the requirements of the public contracting code, and that is one of the reasons why we're here today. So with that general overview,
there. Phil asked me to join today to talk a little bit about the public contracting rewrite that took place during the last session, and there may be some confusion about this bill. The amendment that's being proposed is 2214 to the major rewrite of the procurement law that was passed in the last session. And for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the deputy administrator with the State Service Division. For two interims, a work group had worked on making revisions to state contracting practices. And during the last session, there was an interim work group that preceded that, chaired by Representative Garrard. In fact, I think Representative Nolan was on that committee, and Representative Barnhart, who's not with us today, was on it as well. And there were a variety of stakeholders that came together and looked at the entire procurement landscape, broke off in subcommittees, and developed a complete rewrite to ORS 279. It really fell into three general categories. One was what's now embodied in ORS 279A, which are general provisions that guide all public contracting.
Then there's a separate section of 279, 279B, which govern all procurements other than public works or the typical construction projects, A&E, and related services. And A&E and related services and construction or public works or public improvement contracts are included in 279C. We broke up into a variety of work groups to do this rewrite. I think it's important for this group to understand that when it came to the 279C provisions, a group of stakeholders from the construction industry, from the design industry, came together, and they set some ground rules. And one of those ground rules was that they had to have 100% consensus to change those portions of the statute. And so we worked through all of that. I was one of the co-chairs. Jessica Harris is in the back with us today. She was also a co-chair on this group, on these task groups. And we came together with a rewrite, and the legislature passed that in the last session. We did not address energy-saving performance contracts in that rewrite. We built a tremendous amount of flexibility in that. I believe we built more accountability in the process, and we had 100% stakeholder consensus on what happened in the construction area that ESPCs, or energy-saving performance contracts, are now covered in. Maybe not unbeknownst, but separate from that effort in the last legislative session, there was another bill that was moving along a parallel track. There was never any crossover between these bills, but it was a separate, and it had its own separate policy discussion, and that's House Bill 3476, which Bill Foster can talk about. But I want to, before I turn it over to Bill, I want to say that a bill as large as the one that was passed in the last session is bound to have some technical corrections that need to be corrected to it, and it had several. And there's a bill that's in the Senate right now, House Bill 2214, that contains those technical corrections. One of the corrections that's in that bill that relates to the bill you have is that when it was codified by legislative council, the legislative council codified both bills, 3476 and the procurement code rewrite, and instead of exempting in the codification of that bill, instead of exempting energy saving performance contracts from the competitive bidding requirements of the statute, it mistakenly exempted it from the entire requirement of the public contracting code, or 279. So in House Bill 2214, there's a technical correction which corrects that and takes that exemption out. In fact, in your dash 3 amendment that's in front of you today, it's based on existing statute, which is actually incorrect when it comes to energy saving performance contract. The technical amendment that's being moved through that corrects it is in 2214, and it simply makes energy saving performance contracts not subject to the competitive bidding requirements, but subject to the other provisions of statute. And that's important, because I think when you look at the bill in front of you today, you'll find that the Dash 3 amendments will exempt energy saving performance contracts from all of the public contracting code, with the exception of the language that's in, I believe, Section 10, which is very specific energy saving performance contracts. Now, that may be the policy call that this group wants to make, but you should understand what it's no longer subject to do when you make that. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Bill, and Bill can talk about the intent of House Bill 3476 that was passed last session and what it was intended to do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Department of Energy and the Department of Administrative Services have been working for a number of years on trying to establish an energy savings performance contracting mechanism for Oregon. And the two agencies, along with some consultation with the state of Washington, who has a quite mature program in this area, did a pilot project under an exemption here a few years ago. Then before the 2003 session, the Department of Energy was approached by some of the industry people about maybe putting something in statute. And we worked with both of them, which ended up being House Bill 3476. And it basically exempted energy savings performance contracting from competitive bidding and did not require a specific exemption if the process was conducted according to the model rules that were developed and required under that bill. We deliberately did not put much detail in the statute so that processes could be worked out among public agencies and industry through administrative rule. Additionally, the state agencies had previously had some poor experiences with a similar type of contract, and we tried to learn some lessons from that. It also limits the work under this form of contract to things that are directly or indirectly involved with real savings. I'd like Blake to describe the process of developing those rules.
Before you do, yes. I believe you did identify yourself before, just for the record again.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Foster, Administrator of the Facilities Division.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the rules development process pertaining to ESPCs was really kind of directed by the bill originally. We were required to obtain participation from state agencies, local government representatives, and other knowledgeable persons, including industry representatives, on developing those rules to make sure that they not only met the needs of government contracting folks, but that they made sense when applied in the real world. And that's why the input of these energy companies was so valuable. So during the fall of 2003, I met with not only the state agency representatives and the local government, but also representatives from Johnson Controls, Siemens, Abacus, McKinstry, Quantum Engineering, and eventually representatives of the industry representative for the ESCO companies to obtain input from them both in an informal work session environment and then at the formal hearing that's required prior to the promulgation of the rules. That was kind of the first step. We were required to have those rules in place by January of 2004, and we received very significant input from those industry reps. It was a very big help in making the rules make sense to industry. Everyone got a second bite of the apple, and everyone was advised of that fact, that we would be revising in toto the model rules in 2004 to deal with the very real problems associated with the new public contracting code. We would have a total new public contracting code that would take away all the rules that agencies had been using to do contracts in the past, and so there was going to be a need to totally redo the rules again. So we did that starting in the spring of 2004, culminating in the new model rules as to public contracting on September 1st of 2004. Again, industry reps were encouraged to participate in that process. I received some comments from Johnson Controls in certain aspects of the model rules, and those comments were germane and incorporated into the rules. The industry rep for the ESCOs came to our public hearing on the global model rules rewrite and testified in support of the model, the specific model rules we had developed for ESPC contracting. So a very long process, two bites of the apple, and it was very beneficial to me as the main drafter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Bill Foster, and I wanted to just do a quick description of generically what energy savings performance contracting is about. You know, it's a complicated process, and it's integrating a lot of diverse elements, and it can help unsophisticated agencies achieve their ends, but it also offers a number of pitfalls. As a minimum, it typically includes an audit, design and construction of conservation measures, plus monitoring and verification of the results. Some places and at times it's been expanded to cover financing, maintenance, and other related services, as well as construction activities outside of things that are directly related to the conservation measures. And the common, other common denominator is a performance guarantee that basically says that if the savings aren't achieved, there will be some restitution. I'd like to turn it back to Blake to describe the solicitation process and selection process that we currently have under the model rules.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Blake Underwood of the Department of Justice. The procurement process and the rules, without going into painful detail that might very well put this committee to sleep, is a fairly normal general process, a request for proposal process, whereby this fairly detailed document describing the project is put out by the contracting entity, with a description of the kinds of qualifications and other factors that the agency believes will be key to selecting the appropriate contractor for the project. So it is a public process, a full competitive process. It differs from the competitive bidding process only in the fact that the factors to be considered in awarding the contract are not just price, but in this case for ESCOs would involve not only basic qualifications, financial stability, performance, past performance in terms of how effective they have been in providing these services in the past. There are a number of provisions in the rules that take into account the reality that many agencies have no idea whatsoever what energy savings performance contracting is all about. So it is somewhat of a teaching device to say this is kind of the method that is to be used. These are the factors that are important for you to consider in deciding whether you know how in developing your process. There are some suggestions as to types of how the agreement is put together in terms of the phases that are normally a part of the energy performance contracting process. While House Bill 3476 allowed the Department of Justice to develop model forms, contracting forms, procurement forms for the process, we have developed a number of these documents in the course of advising several agencies on these kinds of transactions, there aren't really a kind of an established set of approved documents. A form of the documents that we used on a couple of earlier transactions, I believe, do appear on the website for the Department of Energy as a general guide, but they're by no means an approved and fully blessed Department of Justice form that everyone can use and know that everything will be fine. But we have tried to give direction in the rules as to that process. The rules do specifically deal with the scope of the energy savings performance contract that can be allowed under the rule. And it specifically does not include new construction, and it does not include maintenance of a facility that has now been completed. There are several reasons for that, which I can go into, but the basic reason for the new construction component was the whole concept of energy savings contracts is there is an existing building that has an existing energy usage that is not very good. The first thing that is done is these folks, the engineers, are much smarter than I am, go in and analyze the building and say, this is the baseline for energy usage in the building. And now we will go in and help you fix this. We, the energy savings contractors, will go in, help you improve the building, and we will guarantee that you will achieve this level of savings from the baseline. With new construction, of course, there is no such baseline. So the idea that these sorts of measures would be used in new construction was inconsistent with the process. The kinds of energy methods, improvement methods in new construction are done as a matter of course by architects, engineers, builders in developing new construction. So it was seen as inconsistent with the process. The maintenance was specifically accepted because of the fact that general maintenance responsibilities for building duties are somewhat separate from construction component and are treated usually differently by the agencies. So also you would be combining a contract that would include effectively evaluation of the building, design of measures, construction of measures, measurement and verification of the measures that had been implemented, now maintenance of the facility for some time in the future. And placing all of those services under one contract was also a consideration.
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, my name is Bill Foster. I think Blake has pretty well walked through what the process was under the rules. The one last piece of that that I wanted to touch on is just how the performance guarantee works. And obviously, as he mentioned, there's some monitoring and verification that's necessary. And typically what we've been doing with the contracts that we've been writing was to put a provision for like a five-year guarantee in it with the option to cancel it early if the agency feels confident that the savings will be achieved. Because basically every year you're paying something to have that guarantee in place. And, you know, what we've found was that as you move along, you get pretty good confidence that you're going to experience that and you really don't need to continue to make those payments. It also means that an agency has an obligation to operate and maintain the equipment so that savings are possible. So that certainly is one of the pieces on that side. So I think at this point we just wanted to express a few of the issues and concerns that we had with the amendment. Want to start, Dugan?
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, my name is Dugan Petty, Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division. My area of concern has to do on page 10 of the Dash 3 Amendment, Section 9. This address in ORS 279A025, that's a section in the public contracting code that says all expenditures or contracts are subject to this code with certain exceptions. And then it provides a list of exceptions that are excluded from the public contracting code. So what the Dash 1 amendment does is it on page 12, line 5, P, it would exempt, as written, energy-saving performance contracts except as provided in Section 10. And then it goes on in Section 10, it identifies the specific conditions that must be included in an energy-saving performance contract. So I think what's important to realize here is when the dust settles on this, if it is enacted as written, there'll be a number of things that will no longer be applicable to this kind of contracting.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Hi, Dugan. Good to see you again. Section 10 has the word may in it. It does not require all of that. It just says it may have it in it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard is exactly right. It is May, so some of those provisions may be included, but not all of them would have to be. Exactly right. As written, what these contracts would no longer be subject to that other contracts are subject to in ORS 279 are the public notice and public advertising provisions. So there's nothing that would require these contracts to be publicly noticed or advertised. There's no provision in here that would have them follow any kind of a competitive solicitation process. And therefore, there's no need to also address the exemption process, which they are currently addressed under in the old bill that was passed last session. There's no protest process. So another offerer or somebody who might have been able to do that, who didn't have a chance at it, wouldn't have a chance to bring a protest forward. At least it wouldn't be guided under the provisions of ORS 279. There's no local contract review board requirements for them to review or approve this kind of contract. There's no Oregon Minority Women and Emerging Small Business provisions in this. There's no provision that it would include the recycling preferences. Any of the preferences that go to awarding of our contracts in the state of Oregon, it would not be subject to. It's not subject to the post-project review for non-competitively bid public improvement contracts. That's a requirement that if it's not competitively bid, there must be a post-review, and that review must be public. There are no bonding requirements that this would be subject to. There are no hours of labor requirements or overtime requirements or any of the other hourly labor requirements that are in our public contracts. There's no pre-qualification process that's often used for construction projects, and there's no ability to protest a pre-qualification process under that. It's not subject to drug testing requirements, which the legislature has moved to be important in public contracts of this type. It's not subject to drug testing, not subject to prevailing wage rates. It's not subject to the prompt pay provisions. So those are just some of the provisions that when it's excluded from the public contracting code, with the exception of those provisions that may be included in Section 10, this would no longer be subject to. So that to us is pretty central to public accountability and how we award contracts. And most of our contracts follow that process or must follow those. This one would not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Blake Underwood with the Department of Justice. Just a couple of additional issues that I would add to Mr. Petty's comments. Retainage requirements is one other particular requirement that is normal in public improvement contracts. That would not be the case with these contracts being totally exempt from the code. We also would be left with the Section 10 provisions, whether there's a couple that are mandatory, but as Representative Girard very well points out, a number of them are permissive. But the level of direction and the level of information about the process and any bargaining power, if you will, that derives from the model rules pertaining to ESPCs would not be available to the contracting agencies. I believe that's all I have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Bill Foster for the record. Just a few other things before we wrap. I think we have some concerns about the way energy conservation is redefined, that it includes any equipment, fixtures, or furnishings, not just those that are directly or indirectly involved with energy savings. It includes new buildings. It includes maintenance cost avoidance. And it includes non-energy resources. The contract provisions have some concerns in that it can base cost recovery on avoided maintenance costs, and that the contract will continue until all paybacks have been received, which means, you know, if you feel the savings are there, you don't end it until the paybacks have occurred. And I think the last comment is that we really have some general concerns about putting this level of detail into statute where other alternative contracting methods such as construction manager general contracting and design build are addressed by rule. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it your intent to enter some changes for either or any of the departments?
Mr. Chairman, we certainly could draft that. I know the Department of Energy and perhaps Michael Graney, who is here, may address that there's some aspects of other portions of it, but we were specifically dealing with that one set of amendments.
All right. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have one question.
Yes. Question from Representative Lynn.
Yes. My bottom line is, thank you very much for the testimony. And my bottom line is, what happened? Even though they give all the guarantees and things like that, if they bankrupt, they might be able to do many buildings and guaranteeing it, and 2-3 years later, they couldn't perform it. They just simply filed the Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Then who's going to be responsible? And what's the amount of the bond they can go?
Representative Lem, very good observation. There are some measures that are currently included within the rules process and the procurement process that would attempt to minimize those sorts of risks. Many of the procurement documents that I've been involved in request very substantial financial information from the entities to evaluate their financial strength and their ability to support the guarantee. Also, there are times where the guarantee is not provided by the main company that you're contracting with. And so in that event, the idea would be to fully evaluate the finances of that entity as well. However, as I'm sure you're aware, those sorts of analyses can be flawed. That is also one of the concerns I have with the Dash 1 Amendment. There's a discussion of financial remedies that are available, and the only remedy that is referenced is a remedy of repaying, that you have paid the contractor for all their work, and now the only remedy for the agency appears to be, the only one that's mentioned, is to go back and get money from the company. So there's no mention of a specific remedy having to do with bonds, which under this provision they would be exempt from. There's no other named remedy whereby the agency could retain funds and not have to go chase the contractor for the money.
Thank you.
Any questions? Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lynn, many of the safeguards that are put in ORS 279 are only there for accountability, but there to protect the public's interest and to make sure that some of these things are addressed. And if you're operating a contract outside those parameters, it's not to say that you couldn't possibly put all those in and contemplate those and be very smart about what you do. But there's not a requirement to do it. And so what could very well happen is agencies, any public agency, could possibly enter into one of these, certainly be in compliance with law if this passed, but not have thought through that and put those kinds of safeguards in place. So there's a certain amount of risk that we take when we do that without complying with those provisions of statute.
Thank you very much.
Seeing no other questions, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Coming today. We'll call Mike Green from the Department of Energy next. Welcome aboard, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mike Rainey, Director of the Department of Energy. First, I want to say that as my assistant director testified a couple weeks ago, we support House Bill 3328. We think it's offers some important measures to increase energy conservation in public buildings, and I want to thank Representative Witt for introducing the bill and for working with us on some changes. Also, we've had a number of conversations with Mr. Kathuri on issues of concern to us, and we did not focus on a lot of the technical aspects of public contracting that you just heard from the DAS and Department of Justice panel. We focused on the energy performance and energy conservation measures themselves. The Dash 2 amendments do respond to a number of concerns we had. And again, I want to thank Representative Witten and Mr. Kerfoy for drafting those. The Dash 3s, which I just saw a few minutes ago, I think to a large extent take care of the concerns that our department had as well on the energy efficiency measures. If things appear that I've missed, that's something I'm sure we could work with Representative Mr. Kathuri to fix on the Senate side if the committee decides to move the bill today. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You wouldn't be interested in making some of those changes now?
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to work with all the parties if that's something that you want us to do.
It's my intent that we probably will hold this for till next week or later if you had some changes that you wanted to make along the lines of what DAS and DOJ had suggested that.
Okay.
I'm sure I'll give you time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, Jessica Adamson and Sean Miller.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to share our comments on this bill, and we apologize for not having come in sooner. It's not often that we see a public contracting-related bill in an environment committee, so I'm happy to be here to share our public contracting expertise with you. This bill, the concept in doing an energy audit and addressing those concerns, we have no issue with that and believe it's smart for the state to do that and find cost savings and be aware of the energy they're using where they can. So we support that component. Section 4 and the related components of the bill that deal with mandatory apprenticeship requirements cause us grave concern, and it is for that reason that AGC opposes this legislation as written. We appreciate Representative Witt's willingness to work with the parties to resolve those issues, but our concern at the same time this bill is designed to create performance savings, the institution of mandatory apprenticeship requirements will negate or perhaps cost the state more than if you did this bill not at all. The conversation about apprenticeship programs is one that is ongoing within our industry, trying to encourage additional workforce, and the development of the construction workforce is an issue where AGC's put its money where its mouth is, and we support the development of a diverse and well-trained industry. It is something that we support greatly, but putting mandatory requirements in public contracts is not the way to ensure that the industry grows and grows well, and so we're very concerned about these provisions and are happy to work to try and remedy this problem in this bill. Finally, I'd like to talk briefly about the Dash 3 amendments. As you heard from Mr. Petty, he and I worked long and hard on the rewrite that passed last session, and I was the kind of subcommittee chair of the public improvement work group that worked on the construction provisions. Having spent that time there, and from my member standpoint, the Dash 3 amendments are very concerning. What happened with House Bill 3476 that created energy for savings performance contracts did what we all agreed to do, which is exempt them from the competitive bidding requirements. They're subject to everything else but competitive bidding. 2341, the rewrite, when it passed, accidentally took them out and made them exempt from the entire code. House Bill 2214, which will hopefully be concurred on soon this session, puts them back in where House Bill 3476 set them, which is exempt from the competitive bidding requirements. This bill would take them back out. So it's a bit of a yo-yo, but the Dash 3 amendments, we are very uncomfortable. If you remove a particular kind of contract from the code, it increases favoritism, does not save the public money, does not open it up to competition. Our members are strongly opposed to that kind of legislation. We're willing to work with Mr. Cafori to address his concerns. We are uncomfortable as well with expanding the definition of what an energy savings performance contract is. We understand the need to efficiently acquire and allow agencies to use easy methods to get projects underway as it relates to energy savings. However, we are not comfortable with the idea that entire buildings or major renovations could be procured under this exemption without some public review. That is unacceptable from our viewpoint, and this language, the way it's written today, would enable very large projects that simply contained a component of energy savings to fall under these provisions. We are willing to work with Mr. Cafori and others to try and resolve those concerns, but as written today, there are major problems with the Dash 3. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Jessica, how long do you think it would take for you to work these out?
Mr. Chair, I believe that we can do this in a couple-hour meeting if all the parties are there and ready to make some adjustments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. And again, like Jessica, I want to commend Representative Witt for introducing the bill to reduce the energy consumption for state buildings, school districts, et cetera. However, our concern lies, as Jessica stated, in Section 4 of the bill that takes another policy direction with regards to apprenticeship and the mandates, particularly on lines 27, which is the 20% mandate of apprenticeship of total hours on these particular projects. The bill goes on to read that these contractors that work on these energy savings contracts shall fulfill the current ratio standards within the applicable apprenticeship programs. Mr. Chair, I just want to state that in apprenticeship, and there's several bills in this particular building to deal with apprenticeship policy on a statewide basis, on a public project basis. I know Commissioner Dan Gardner has introduced a bill, Senate Bill 150, that is working through some apprenticeship on a public project that he would like to see through this process. My groups have introduced bills that are in the business committee to deal with the needs test of apprenticeship to actually encourage more competition among apprenticeship programs, which actually we believe promote apprenticeship. There's other bills, Mr. Chairman, that deal with the ratio in particular, and that has been debated in the business committee as well in the House. Again, this particular mandate of 20%, if this is about apprenticeship and jobs, we have introduced a bill that actually puts apprenticeship ratio at a one-to-one, one journeyman to one apprentice ratio, which we believe encourages more job opportunities and encourages more people into the construction industry. Again, that's a policy issue that has been debated, and again, there's two sides of that issue. I know Mr. Or former Representative Shipwreck is going to follow me, and we have debated these issues at length, and I believe this particular issue, again, is a broader issue of apprenticeship policy, and we don't think we should have Section 4 in this particular bill, again, that only deals with energy savings performance contracts. If we're going to look at apprenticeship, I think the industry, including business, labor, and the commissioner and all of the parties interested in apprenticeship should be at the table to discuss those issues. And therefore, Mr. Chairman, we would respectfully ask that Section 4 come out of the bill, and we would again lift our opposition to the bill if that's done. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Very good. Appreciate you coming. I'm going to call David Bell and Peter White. And Mr. Corfori, did you want to... Okay. Brad, did you want to speak again? Okay, great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Stephen Gafori with Johnson Controls. I just wanted to repeat what I said before, and that was, I think we've got a drafting error. I think there's a couple of drafting errors in this bill, frankly, and I'm not unhappy about the option of working with the people who have testified in cleaning those up. But on page 12, where you see the Energy Saving Performance Contract, except as provided in Section 10 of this Act, was not intended by us to exempt us from limited minority contract provisions and hourly requirements and wage and hour payments and all those kinds of stuff. So I'd be happy to get that straightened out and clarify. We're just talking about getting out from under competitive bidding processes, which really will have these folks are going to talk about how we can get the most out of energy saving performance contracts. So Peter White is from Johnson Controls.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Appreciate your time. I'm Peter White. My title is Public Sector Solutions Manager for Johnson Controls in Western United States, which is basically all the states west of the Mississippi and Canada. And I guess I'd like to bring up a point that gives me a little bit of perspective as to what some states do regarding these types of measures, some things that I've seen work in other states and even in other countries in terms of this kind of procurement policy. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, and then primarily the two major concerns that have been discussed today is in the areas of maintenance being included in projects, and then also performance contracting as it pertains to new construction. And I'll talk a little bit about a couple of projects that have been done in Oregon under that scenario and have been viewed as favorable by county commissioners and such. So if you take a look at this, I don't know if these have been distributed. These get passed around?
Yes.
All this is just supported data. I don't expect you to look at this right now, but in it there is a four-page article regarding maintenance. And if I could back up and talk a little bit about performance contracting, in its bare essential, we are looking for ways to save money to pay for the improvements of existing buildings, or in new construction applications, taking a look at lowest life cycle cost being important to a building and guaranteeing that. So we're actually, over the course of time, reducing the cost of ownership of a facility. So with that, the maintenance is a key and critical aspect of that, because over 50% of the cost of owning a building over 40 years has to do with energy costs and then also operational costs. So if you have a maintenance program, what you'll see in this write-up, and there's a lot of other documentation that we can supply to you, has to do with ensuring that you have a safe, basically a productive piece of equipment from an energy performance standpoint, and then also minimizing the cost to have that asset in your building over time. In other words, if you take good care of your equipment, just like you change your oil in your car, it's going to last longer and cost you less. And that also dovetails with sustainability, and that's key and critical to the other two articles that you'll see in here, and that has to do with LEED, which is a leadership for energy and environmental design. And that basically is measuring your buildings, saying that they're very, very efficient. And so you'll see write-ups regarding that. If we do performance contracting on new facilities, what you'll be doing is you'll be guaranteeing that the buildings are operating, they're built, designed, and built very efficiently, and that over time, they're also going to be performing very efficiently. So those are going to save taxpayers' dollars. So those are things that we think are key and critical. Now, the biggest concern that we have currently is that in many, many states, we're in a situation where we can do performance contracting easily. In other words, they want to see that the programs are self-funded and that the companies that are doing this are credible. And so if we're in a situation where that is the measure by which you go ahead and contract on, that's been the most efficient. If we have to go out for a formal request for proposal, it takes a lot of time. And the faster we can do this, and the more easy it is for the end user, the people who are actually in the buildings, to go ahead and contract for this, they'll do more of it in our state. So if you have a state energy mandate, the most efficient way to do it is to have what we call enabling legislation and stuff that is very easy to work with for the end user and for the contractor. And I can tell you this, I have several people that work for me, and I look to states that have more favorable legislation. In other words, they're looking for a program that is self-funding, and you're able to negotiate. And I actually put more resources in those states because I know that we can do more business faster. Now, the nice thing about that is that we're doing more energy savings programs in those states so that the state people are saving more money.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you for interrupting that. I don't know, just as a member of this committee, I would feel that these folks should be addressing all the problems in the Dash 3 with us rather than the commercials for Johnson Controls.
I'd like to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, anything that we're saying here, first of all, in terms of Johnson Controls, we're talking about for the industry, not just our company, but any company, and you heard the list of them earlier, of other companies that do the same kind of work. And what is true for us is true for them. I don't know why none of them are here today, but that's not an indication that they're not just as going to be as responsive to this bill once it passes as we are. Secondly, the problems of the Dash 3, are basically twofold as I see it. One is their dispute, which I just heard about at noon today, between two groups, two interest groups, about whether there ought to be mandatory apprenticeship or not. This is not our issue. We came upon Representative Witt's bill, which was introduced at the request of an organization called Apollo, and this is a nationwide organization that has two goals. One is environmental concerns and the other is jobs. And so they produced this bill, which they thought would be good for both the environment and for jobs, and that's where the apprenticeship is part of it. We hopped on Representative Witt's bill. What happens on that issue about apprenticeships, we'll let them work out between the people who testified in favor and testified against it. It's not our call, so we don't care, as long as it's resolved somewhere that doesn't inhibit this bill from going forward. The other thing is that I believe that I said before that there was, when you've got these bills going back and forth, 2214 and whatever the one from last session was, and sometimes the things get confused in legislative council, and they're drafting from existing statute, not from the bill that's on the way going through the process. It is not our desire to exempt us from requirements that for women and minority contracts. It's not our desire to exempt us from the statutes that have to do with wage and hour. It's not our desire to exempt ourselves from the things you heard about, all that kind of stuff. We'll be happy to get out of that. We think we can do that pretty quickly. I think Jessica's absolutely right. We can work those out. We're not in disagreement on that.
I'm going to ask you to close out. We've got another 15 minutes to cover another bill. So if you could just close up your testimony. And
absolutely, Mr. Chairman. In short, what we're looking for is a very simple, easy methodology of procurement where we're able to negotiate performance contracts just like is allowed in Colorado, California, Kansas, Minnesota, states where they're doing a lot more energy conservation faster, easier, and saving their state taxpayers' dollars because of it.
Thank you. So you need to present? All set? Okay, fine. I'll call our last witness, John O'Shell.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, John O'Shell with the Association of Oregon Counties. I can be quite brief. Most of the prime issues of the bill pertaining to the energy-saving contracts, that's been covered. I need to do not need to go into that. Our concern is with the Section 4 apprenticeship program. There is another bill, as you're aware, Senate Bill 150 floating around that deals with apprenticeship that we basically work with to come up with a compromise answer as to where we were okay. We would like to see those provisions added. Let's at least get consistent. Our issue specifically with the apprenticeship programs as proposed is it takes out the little contractors. Counties have a lot of small counties that do small contracts, and if you put a contract that forces them into a apprenticeship program at $100,000, you take out our small, local, small-time, small-town contractors. Senate Bill 150 has a threshold of $350,000, does not require apprenticeship to be used on the projects. We're okay with that. What's in this bill we think would take out the small contractors, so we would oppose. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to direct that all of the parties, Mr. Kapoori, Jessica, Sean, DAS, DOJ, Department of Energy, that each of you could get together and bring this back to us as a really clean bill here. And hopefully next week, but we'll give you a little time if you need more. Thank you all.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could just suggest that maybe that could be coordinated through Representative Witt's office.
That'd be excellent.
Since he is the sponsor of the bill.
Excellent.
I might give it a little more direction.
Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on 3328.
Majority of people out here. With the majority of the people out here.
Okay. Yeah, I will. I'm going to open a brief work session on Senate hearing on Senate Bill 55A, and I will hear only those who are here from more than 100 miles or really out of the area. All right. 2, 3, 4. Okay. All right. If you'll come up and present now.
Good
Gallagher, would you like to come and just kind of tie this together for a second?
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Gallagher here on a volunteer basis for the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveyors. There's one very good issue in this bill that the committee should take a look at. There's a lot of people who have been following this board hearing and who have come up here and have volunteered to testify. Mm-hmm. I think it would be appropriate if you wanted to very quickly to get their position on the record. I don't think they will go through there are two groups that are very well qualified to deal with the technical debate on the bill. So I think if you do this very quickly, they can testify.
That'd be wonderful. My problem is we have another committee coming in here at 3. So I don't think we'll get through all the testimony. I would like to give anybody who probably will not be back a chance to come and state their...
Mr. Chair, how much time are you going to give the bill? 10 minutes?
15 maybe.
Well, I think we could probably do the bill in 15 without all the testimony.
Okay. Great.
But we'd have to start with a different way to testify rather than the people from far away. Because they'll testify if they need
to. If you'll direct the testifier.
Okay. So if we'd start with another panel, we will do our share here in about 6 minutes.
That'll be great.
And while they're coming up, Mr. Chair, let me introduce this bill passed out of the Senate. This is a bill from a state licensing board, and it changes... a couple of the practices in the bill to expand the bill to include photogrammetry and geodetic surveying. And the controversial piece will be in Section 7, which is a discussion of surveying. A number of other interest groups have been involved in looking at these amendments and have gotten themselves specifically into the amendments as exemptions so that they're clearly exempted from the purview of this bill. All of those groups are in the Dash 5 amendment. So if you were, when you go to move the bill, if you move the bill, the Dash 5 amendments will need to be adopted to Senate Bill 55A. Now with me are two members of the Board of OSBIL, Dan Linscheid, who's a surveyor, and Dean Anderson, who's an engineer. And they're both officers on the board, and they're the people that drafted this bill. So I'll let Dan present the quick overview of the bill and the problem that the committee will have to review.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Dan Linscheid. I'm a member of OSBILS. However, I want to make one slight correction to Tom's statement. Dean Anderson is the GIS director for Polk County. And he's not an engineer or a member of the board. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dean. Let him roll.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm from Polk County. In the 2001 session of the legislature, during a hearing on HB 3944, groups of professionals were directed by a House committee to go out and iron out their differences regarding the definition of the practice of land surveying. SB 55, which is what you have in front of you, is the result of integrating the National Council of Examiners and Engineers and Land Surveyors model law into Oregon laws, updating various definitions relating to surveying, photogrammetry, GIS, and cartography. The proposal before you ensures that those who use the tools such as GPS, the little handheld that tell you where you are, within their profession don't harm the public by practicing land surveying. It also creates a new licensure for photogrammetrists. The amendments ensure that others can do their jobs without fear that they may be practicing land surveying. The proposal has been reviewed by two Oregon Assistant Attorney Generals to make sure it has no unintended consequences and complies with other rules and regulations. We've gone over this with many organizations, including the League of Oregon Cities, who are fine with this. It does have a bit of controversy in Section 7. Some say that I'm not a surveyor, I'm a GIS professional. And the concern is that maybe the definition of the surveying is too broad in Section 7. As a GIS professional providing services to a wide variety of folks for about 25 years, I'm very comfortable with that broader definition. Basically, in that particular area, it defines the definition of practice of surveying fairly broadly, and it needs to. The current law that we do have, supported by administrative rules, is fairly broad, and it defines when you are surveying and when you are not by how you do a particular job. So, for example, if you had a piece of land and I came out and said, well, this looks like it's your land, I'm not practicing surveying. If I got to the edge of and found a monument on your land and said, look, that's your property corner, well, then I am practicing surveying. And it isn't just that. It's any time you go out and find a position on the ground and say, with authority, it's here. Then you're practicing surveying, and so that others are going to use it to build other surveyors or do other engineering activities on it. And that's why it's broad. When you do it that way, set it up that way, it really begins to, you have to identify, okay, when are you not surveying? And that's what the exemptions are about. I'm pretty comfortable with how this bill was developed. It's taken us 4 years with many, many organizations to make this happen, and appreciate being allowed to give you testimony.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and the committee, thank you for having us this afternoon. My name's Romy Ware. I'm the Douglas County Surveyor. And to my right here is Ron Schofield, Land Use Consultant, and David Jakes. And I'm going to defer to Ron here for first part of the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, as Mr. Ware indicated, I'm a land use planning consultant. I'm in private practice in Roseburg down in Douglas County. My interest here today is very narrowly focused. I am not a land surveyor, and one might think, then why am I concerned about this bill? My concern is focused, I think, very narrowly. My concern is focused on Section 7, Sub 2, Sub A, which essentially establishes a very broad definition of the practice of surveying. Below that subsection, the bill then will go on and add some more specific provisions. Our issue is not so much with the specific provisions. In fact, we think many of those are vast improvements over the current definition of land surveying in the state of Oregon. Our concern is, again, principally with the language proposed under subsection A of subsection 2 of subsection of section 7 of the bill. We believe that this language casts a very broad, unreasonably broad net, that it captures many trades and professions that it probably did not intend to do. We think it has the potential for conflict later on once we attempt to implement these provisions. We think it is unnecessary. We don't think that it really adds anything to what is already included in the bill below it. My concern from my own personal perspective is that because of the types of practices I engage in as a land use consultant and dealing with property, that I may be pulled into that broad net. That's my primary concern. All we are basically asking is that the subsection A language, the more or less the preface of the of that section, be eliminated. We have suggested a couple of other, what I might term as friendly amendments. We think those are less important to the bigger issue of eliminating that prefatory language. Basically, that's the limit of our concern, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Question, Representative Jensen.
When you're talking about eliminating Section 7, Sub 2, Sub A, are you including then under the elimination of that Sub A all of the following parts from uppercase A through what would be line 24 on page 4?
Representative Jensen, first of all, let me apologize. We've not had a chance to see the latest version of the bill, and so the one that we may have may not correspond directly with yours. Our concern is limited to the section that starts out with the wording A, providing or offering to provide professional services, continues down through large A, then items 1, 2, and 3, and finishes up with large B, that ends with the words projects or other survey products. It's a relatively short section at the top of Section 7 of the bill. If you're following
me. You're not concerned with B then on B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J.
Correct. Where it starts out, performing geodetic surveys and continuing on. As I said, we proposed some friendly amendments to that we think may improve it, but those are not our main issues. Our main concern is getting rid of what we think is an unnecessarily broad definition in this beginning section. We were informed earlier today that as this bill has gone through a couple of amendments, we are now up to something in the neighborhood of 19 trades and practices that have been exempted because people have raised the same question that I'm raising this afternoon. And our concern is that if the bill were more carefully crafted, it would not be necessary to have such a long list, laundry list of those that are exempted. The only ones that have been exempted are those are the ones that have been thought of so far. And our concern is that there may be, and we're sure there are, many more out there that should also be exempted. But we don't think that the purpose of the bill should be to provide a laundry list of who's exempt. We think that it should be more carefully crafted to say who is included. And we think that can be accomplished through just the elimination of this first set of terms.
Would you like the committee to enter these for amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would make that request.
Okay.
Thank you.
David.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, David Jakes, I reside in Roseburg, Oregon. Purpose of my visit today is to, again, express concerns with this bill. I'm not a licensed surveyor or engineer, and I don't purport to offer any expertise relative to their trade, but I do have a couple of capacities that I operate in my profession and also as a volunteer. I'm the chairman of the Douglas County Planning Commission, and I'm also a licensed real estate broker. And I think, as has been evidenced by Dash 5 amendments that Mr. Schofield referenced, when we have 19 exemptions of different groups that have been pulled out of this, it gives recognition to the fact that there is some unintended consequence in trying to define the definition of surveying. One of the concerns in specific I'd like to call your attention to is in the Douglas County Planning Commission, which I'm now in my 10th year on that board. I've had some experience in this. We oftentimes will have professional testimony from individuals such as Mr. Schofield bringing in detailed professional information. My concern, just as in the case of the state police who have now been exempted from this, if they were measuring a crime scene, there was a concern that maybe some of the evidence would have to be thrown out because they didn't have a licensed surveyor doing the measurements on that crime scene. So they've been rightfully exempted. Similarly, my concern would be that we've gone through a rather comprehensive land use hearing process and a quasi-judicial hearing process, having arrived at a ruling, which may be subsequently upheld by the Board of Commissioners, and then having that ruling challenged because, for example, maybe one of the activities that we were relying on in reaching our decision was not in conformance with this law as it's written. So we think that that has the potential to do great harm to the public and to encumber an already heavily encumbered process when we're waiting through land use regulations in the state of Oregon. So I think that it would be in the committee's interest in those that have attempted to create a good piece of legislation here in the interest of all Oregonians to pursue the course that Mr. Schofield had outlined in taking out that section.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Romy Ware. This portion of the of this bill that we're looking at, this definition, is language that was adopted. It's model law language that was authored by the National Council of Examiners for Engineers and Surveyors, NCEES. I contacted Lee Fricks, manager of records department for NCEES in Clemson, South Carolina, and had a discussion with her about this. And my questions to her was, how long has this model law been out there? And she informed me that it's been there since 1995. 10 years. I then asked her, how many states have adopted this model law language? And she replied, zero. 10 years, zero states. She did seem somewhat excited when I told her that Oregon is coming close to adopting this language, and she said, oh great, let me know, because we'd love to write an article that Oregon being the first state to adopt this language. So with that, my testimony rests.
Okay, thank you for your questions. Thank you all. Is there anyone else that
thank you
needs to testify? Will. Okay, one more.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Dan Lynchite again with Osbeals and also the Yamhill County Surveyor. Just a little bit of background on that, the last statement by Mr. Ware. The model law was proposed in 1995. I was in Baltimore in 2004 when it was finally adopted. So it has not, all the states have been afraid to adopt this until it went through all the processes, and there was a multi-organizational group that was comprised of a whole bunch of acronyms I can't even begin to recite that were involved with coming up with this model law and the model rules. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of additional background. We're only a little over a year down the pike on this, so as far as the model rule having been adopted nationally.
Okay.
Any other questions? Any other information?
Nope. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much. I am sorry for the conflict in time. We will hold this over until Tuesday, give you some time to get back to us. And we do have a number of others to testify yet. But we will try and deal with it first up on Tuesday. So we will close the work session on the House Bill, on Senate Bill 55A, and we will adjourn the committee.
Meeting.